ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
What if she is the one? The one who'll break the spell?
I want to help you. There must be some way to break the curse.
This beast is a threat to our very existence!
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Sir Chad Riley.
Bonjour.
That's right. Chad is French. We didn't know that, but he is.
Oui, oui.
We got a great show. You know what?
If now
you
have expired my entire knowledge of the French language.
If you and McGregor can do it, you can do it. So that's all I got to say about that. But we got a great show in store for you guys today as we'll review a really timeless classic redone by Disney. And so we're excited.
Very excited. I mean, this is the thing for Disney now. This is the thing that they do.
Yep.
Turn a cartoon into a live action film and see if we still love it.
That's right. The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live in an enchanted castle where the appliances and utensils spend all day singing, also known as VGB Studios. Be our guest and subscribe to The Filmlosophers on your favorite platform for weekly movie reviews and other great content. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Google Play, Libsyn, Stitcher, iTunes, Audioboom, and Player FM. Think we're boorish and brainless?
Never.
Tell us. We just ask that you keep it family-friendly. Like
Please.
The show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101 to share your opinion and discuss movie news all week long. Finally, visit us online at vgbstudios.com where you'll find our full episode library alongside other amazing podcasts like Video Game Bang and me, myself, and I.
Great company to be in.
It is. You know what? We enjoy the company of these gentlemen, and it's, you know, they make for great table talk.
It's a good podcasting family.
That's true. But you know what? Since we're so excited, let's just jump right into the review of Beauty and the Beast. Now, of course, everybody knows the timeless classic, the film that has pretty much been a part of every single person's childhood. If you're young enough to remember it as a child, if you're not young enough to remember it as a child, then you're old enough to remember it as a part of your child's upbringing. You know, you remember taking your kids to see this film or whatever. I actually remember going to the theaters and seeing the original.
Oh, sure.
So,
yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you said, you know, it's so timeless. I don't know how timeless it was until the animated film in, what, 91?
Yeah. 1991.
Which, I mean, it like was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars.
Yeah.
As an animated movie when they didn't have a category for animated films. So, I mean, it says something.
Yep. And like we said, we are talking about Beauty and the Beast, the 2017 redo, remake, redux, recreation, however you want to call it.
Yeah, I mean, it's an adaptation.
It's a live-action adaptation. You know. So in this film, obviously, we have your characters that everybody remembers. You know, Belle, a bright, beautiful, and independent young woman, is taken prisoner by a beast in its castle. Despite her fears, she befriends the castle's enchanted staff and learns to look beyond the beast's hideous exterior, allowing her to recognize the kind soul and heart of the true prince that hides on the inside. Directed by Bill Condon, the film stars Emma Watson, Dan Stevens, Luke Evans, Josh Gad, Ewan McGregor, Ian McKellen, and...
Emma Thompson. Mrs. Potts.
That's right. I didn't think, honestly...
I always found it interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt
you. No.
So many of these characters speak with a British accent, but, like, Ewan McGregor totally went, like, very French with the way he did his Lumiere, right? Because, like, it's actually set in France.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I guess I knew when I was a kid and I saw the cartoon film, the animated film, but you don't think about those things when you're young. Like, why are they all talking like they're British when they're supposed to be... I guess Lumiere did... The cartoon Lumiere also was very French.
He was.
But, like, the rest of them weren't. Belle was
no
American, wasn't yeah. she? I mean, it was
everybody had the American accent.
Anyway, it's interesting because this movie, the live action adaptation, does go to great lengths to play up the kind of Baroque French setting of the film, and yet mm-hmm. they didn't force all of their performers to, you know, do accents, but then one of them does, and it was interesting.
And not bad. And speaking of going off of earlier from about Emma Thompson, you know, it's odd to see somebody else portray Mrs. Potts instead of Angela Lansbury. I think she made such an iconic presence with that role that it was kind of almost like, you know, sacrilegious to have someone else come into that role and say, oh, I'll play her. So we'll get into what we thought about that in a little bit. But this year's first Disney live action reboot, and Beauty and the Beast ended its opening weekend at $174 million, over close to $175 in the North America box offices, which actually allows it to join the ranks of the top 10 biggest opening weekends, beating out Iron Man 3 for the number 6 spot.
Yeah, not only did it get into the top 10, but it got to number 6. I mean, it's so many films have earned a lot of money, especially during the summer blockbuster season. So many films have earned a lot of money by this point that to even get into that echelon is a challenge. But yeah. then, like, to get, like, all the way in on your opening weekend, that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, and it's not even the incredibleness, the awesomeness. I'm using all my technical words. The ostentatious
all those technical worms.
All my technical worms. The incredible aspect of this whole feat in itself isn't just the fact that they broke into the top 10. The fact that it's so incredible is that they broke into the top 10 at the beginning of the year still. This isn't a summer blockbuster. This isn't one of those films that was hyped up for December like Star Wars. This wasn't a you know, one of those types of films where the setting is usually primed for them. You know, everybody waits for the summer blockbuster. Everybody waits for the big Oscar season, you know, blowouts. Everyone looks sure. for the big, you know, Lucasfilm project that's
coming
out. Well,
I think it's a testament to the original, to the animated film. I mm-hmm. think that there was so much anticipation because obviously you had to be hiding under a rock to not know that this movie was coming out.
Yeah.
They definitely did market the film.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the huge result that you've seen, obviously, yes, parents are taking their kids. Like, people who grew up, they saw the film as a kid, now have kids of their own mm-hmm. and want them to have a similar experience. So they took them to the theater. Some people our age just wanted to see it for themselves,
yeah.
you know, just to kind of get that nostalgic effect or see what was different or, you know, whatever it might be. But I think that a lot of the anticipation and kind of the opening weekend, you know, the big haul yeah. was because the original film that this is adapting, you know, with all the musical numbers and everything is truly beloved by a lot of people around the world.
Oh, no doubt. And I think Disney was very smart about this in terms of the timing of this. Like you said, you have the age group of those who were old enough to remember it as a child, but then now have children of their own. And you have the individuals who remember it from, you know, their older brothers or whatever. They're cashing in on two demographics right now that will obviously pay, as we can see with the numbers, will obviously pay to see this and get those, you know, all them feels back and everything. People who remember it as a kid now are taking their kids, you know, and it's that generation that we're in right now where I honestly believe if Disney had waited like at least another 3, 4, even 5 years, I think they would have missed the boat. They would have missed that window of opportunity because then it seemed like it would have been past the time. And I think as trends are moving, that's one of those things where that nostalgia fever would have move past it. And
interesting. I don't know. I mean, I think that the thing that would have really screwed things up for Disney is if they weren't as faithful to the animated film as they were. Now, granted, there are quite a few things that are different, either, you know, more or less than what you may have been expecting based on the animated film. But for the most part, it's extremely faithful
yeah.
to the cartoon.
So speaking of it, you know, we're just going to jump right into the review and, you know, go and write and start talking about it. But in terms of the film, going into it, I was expecting exactly what I had seen in the trailers. I expected what looked to be a shot-for-shot redone, a reboot, a shot-for-shot live-action adaptation. I expected to not really see anything out of the ordinary other than seeing the storyline that I'm familiar with, and almost in a mindset, I was honestly coming in half expecting to be able to quote the film word for word. Honestly, because
as it was happening,
yeah. Knowing that, okay, they didn't really, in my mind from the trailers, they didn't really want to stretch too far from the original source material. The catch, the draw in, I guess, the bait, if you will, was that it was going to be adapted into a live action, you know, film. So people were going to see all the things that they, you know, remember from the film.
Sure.
In live action. And mind you, I was one of those people like, okay, this should be interesting. You know, we'll check it out. So those were my impressions going in. What about you?
Yeah, I think before seeing the movie, the only thing that I knew about it that may be out of the ordinary was they said that there were a couple of new songs that weren't in the animated film.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out there are more than a couple. There are four, I believe, in the finished product of this live-action film. So there are the songs that you're used to from... I mean, if you're old enough to have had this in your childhood,
mm-hmm.
Or to have seen it along the way, then you know the songs from before. They're extremely iconic. They were very well received at the time,
mm-hmm.
and very popular. Some of, you know, the Tale as Old as Time or whatever was on the radio for a long time. And, you know, so you've got all those, but you do have other songs in there. That was the only thing that I knew that was different, aside from a little bit of what they did with the design of the character of the Beast, the visual effects for the Beast. Like, it looked a little bit different than what I was expecting based on the cartoon. But yeah, I was basically, like you said, expecting almost shot for shot recreation, kind of similar to, and I know that this is verging outside of this particular genre for some who might be listening for the first time, but the Watchmen movie.
Yeah.
When Zack Snyder did Watchmen and really was working to be panel by panel faithful to the original graphic novel, I expected a similar approach here. I think by and large they did do a lot of the same things, but there are quite a few differences starting right at the very top.
Yeah, right from the get-go, you know, as we're introduced to the characters, as we're introduced to the film, the opening, which seems to be a little bit more, you know, picturesque, I guess, when you're seeing it in the cartoon, how it's portrayed through the stained glass window and everything.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
This is more, obviously, it's acted out. They took the opportunity to create an actual scene that most people aren't familiar with, and you see how that whole thing transgresses. But as you're introduced to the characters, you know, we're introduced to, obviously, Dan Stevens as the Beast.
You're first introduced to him as the prince.
As the prince.
Yeah.
Which gives you more credence to...
He has, like, this dinner party thing going on.
Yeah.
With the high society of the time. It very much embraces that Baroque French. I mean, it's very... It looks like, you know, a Louis the 16th, Marie Antoinette kind of...
Powdered
know, masquerade
wigs and,
sort
you know,
of party.
Yeah. And it actually... You know what? One of the things that I have to appreciate is giving more context to that opening scene. Now, with the cartoon, you're just given like, oh, so this prince opened the door, he didn't let this old woman in to stay with them,
mm-hmm.
she turns him into a beast and enchants the entire castle. That's what you're given in the animated version. This one actually delves a little deeper into the character structure of, you know, the prince in terms of his, you know, his attitude, his heart, and how he is with other people, and how he is with the townspeople, and the reasons why, and what happens, and it expands upon on that curse, which there are things about that curse I didn't really fully know until I saw this movie, you know, thankfully. And so, like we said, you're introduced to the prince slash the beast, and then you're introduced to Belle and the townspeople with that iconic opening scene, and Emma Watson does a decent job. We got a British accented actress playing a French woman in the French countryside.
Which is, you know, no better or worse than an American actress doing the voice in the cartoon.
Exactly. No, I'm just plucking hairs here.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because they gave a little more time to that opening sequence mm-hmm. about the curse and yeah. how that happened. And then you have this big establishing shot and sequence with the camera where you're following Belle, you know, through her morning routine, you know, mm-hmm. the whole, you know, there she goes, Bonjour. that girl's strange and whatever, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, she's a bookworm and she's going to the library to get a book that she's already read a dozen times, but she wants to read it again. And mm-hmm. everybody thinks that's odd because here you have a literate, empowered woman
yeah.
in an age and in a society where that was not commonplace. I think that there's a lot more, if I were a parent, which I'm not, but if I were a parent, there would be a lot more meat to discuss with my kids after seeing the movie mm. in this version than in the cartoon version.
Yeah, yeah. And so as the film goes on, we're introduced to Maurice, which is so much more less clumsy, I guess, than the animated version. Kevin Kline plays Maurice, and I enjoyed him as Maurice in terms of his more fatherly aspect instead of the fumbling inventor that we got from the animated version.
Yeah, I mean, he's literally a cartoon in the cartoon.
Exactly,
like, he's literally a cartoon character and not all that realistic.
And this gives him...
He's lovable. I mean, you like
yeah.
him.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, of course. He's that, you know, cute, you know, lovable older father figure that, you know, everybody wants to have and squeeze and everything. But Kevin Kline is more of a contemplative, more... he's a tinker. He's not an inventor in this one, I believe, because I didn't see him building anything brand new.
Right. He doesn't have some giant wood chopping machine.
Yeah. He's a tinker. He builds, you know, he helps repair or create little... you know, boxes, these music boxes, whatever. So we're introduced to him. And of course, we're introduced to Gaston and LeFou, played by Luke Evans and Josh Gad, respectively. And Luke Evans, one of the high points for me in the film. I actually enjoyed seeing this performance of Gaston. Not that the cartoon was bad, but I actually enjoyed seeing him with a little bit more depth. It wasn't just like, oh, by the way, this is Gaston. He's a jerk. Everybody should know that.
Yeah, he's vain, conceited, and everybody goes along with it.
Yeah.
This actually gives him a story, like yeah. something, you know, he was, a lieutenant or something in
yeah, he
the
was some
army,
type of, yeah.
and you know, he had, there's a backstory. Several of
yes.
them have backstories in the live-action version that didn't really need to be a part of the cartoon, but, you know, they certainly weren't part of the animated version.
No.
Now you kind of know where, over the course of the film, you see where many of them have come from before mm-hmm. the story begins.
And the incredible thing about that is that I want to know more, because they've made several mentions of, you know, this war that Gaston was a part of before, because that's the first thing he says when he's coming in to town, you know, when he...
Sure.
And they mention this war. I'm like, what war? What is he talking about? I want to see Gaston in war. I would love to see a whole 300 sequence with Gaston going through and just taking people out.
300.
Just all super slow-mo. We were talking about Zack Snyder, super slow-mo Zack Snyder with the wacha, wacha, and then turn and do the dazzling smile to the camera. I could see that working out.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to me. I've never read the book upon which the entire story is based, but I don't know to what degree these backstories exist in literature and just mm-hmm. weren't included, you know, for sake of time or, you know, yeah. priority or whatever, weren't included in the 1991 film, that they do now have some reflection here.
And of course, like we said, LeFou is introduced, portrayed by Josh Gad. You know, roughly pretty much similar to his portrayal in the cartoon. I mean, not as bumbling. He's given a little bit more depth. He's given a little bit more of a...
He's more self-aware, I yeah. think. The thing that makes the difference, because he still has, like, campy, funny moment. I mean, LeFou, really, I mean, he's the fool. That's what his purpose is. But then, in a way, they kind of move, and I'm sorry, I'm going to go a little bit more like high school age or whatever, but they kind of move a little bit in the Shakespearean direction.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get there, but oftentimes in like Shakespearean era writing, if you have a character called the Fool, oftentimes they're the actual, like, wisest one.
Yeah.
They understand the situations of the play or the book or whatever it is, the story, at a higher level than any of the other players. Mm-hmm. And they don't quite get there with LeFou here in this film, but at the very least, they make him more self-aware. He does have some asides that he does with the camera. Like, he's speaking to the audience in many ways, sometimes, where the other characters never do that.
Yeah.
So they do kind of move into that classical, like, you know, that you call somebody a fool, and they look like a fool, but in fact, they might have wisdom that none of the other characters have, primarily in kind of like a, you know, breaking the fourth wall,
yeah,
Deadpool kind of way. You know, it's that awareness that there's an audience outside of the scene.
True, true.
And they do play up to that a little bit.
Oh, yeah,
I thought
definitely.
It was, you know, really intriguing.
I agree wholeheartedly with this particular character. I do believe he did have like this central vein of the entire film where he was kind of in tune with more of all the things that were going on as opposed to just what was happening with him and Gaston, which is where the focus was in terms of the cartoon. And of course, we move towards what is in the castle. And obviously, we are introduced to Chip. We're introduced to Mrs. Potts, played by Emma Thompson. Cogsworth, played by Sir Ian McKellen. Lumiere, who's played by Ewan McGregor. I thought it was really interesting seeing. Of course, Stanley Tucci as the harpsichord.
I was going to say, you've got Audra McDonald as the wardrobe opera singer, Stanley Tucci as the harpsichord player, Gugu Mbatha-Raw is the plumette, Lumiere's, yeah, you know, love interest.
There you go.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's interesting because you do the beginning of the film, aside from the very first sequence where you got a little bit more of the prince's backstory. But then from that point, the beginning of the film is almost like one for one faithful to the animated film all mm-hmm. the way through. You know, the Maurice and the horse go the wrong path. They get attacked and chased by wolves. You know, it was scary. I had this little beside me in the theater. There was a father and his little girl. It was a daddy-daughter date.
Aww.
And the little girl was 6 or 7 maybe. And she was just adorable. And yeah, during the wolf sequences, you know, it's loud, it's scary.
Yeah, of course.
One of the wolves has a scar on his eye and is snarling and whatever. So
he's
second
cousin to Scar from Africa.
She was literally like curled sideways into her father, but still wanted to see what was going on. She was adorable. So for those of you that do have small children and are considering taking them to see the film, just know that some of the things that are scary in the cartoon mm-hmm. are also in the live action version, and they look more real.
Yes.
So just be ready to, you know, have your child bury their face in your side for a little while. It happens. It's adorable.
And one of the other things too that the film does kind of incorporate, it does incorporate a sense of visual accurateness, you know, in terms of the way these characters, the way these, I don't want to call them utensils, but the like Lumiere and
the enchanted items, they don't look like they did in the cartoon.
They don't have visible eyes. They don't have, like, they do, but they're made in the thought process that it's part of the working organism as a whole, whatever they are. So obviously Cogsworth's eyes are like part of the clock face, and it's not so pronounced like it was in the film. You have legitimate objects that are come to life that look like they could have, you know, humanistic
features.
And
sometimes when, like, Maurice first enters the castle and doesn't know that it's enchanted, they look like objects sitting on a table.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look like they're going to come to life.
Yeah. And that was a unique aspect. That was a unique addition to the film. Obviously, they could have gone the cartoony route, and that would have looked a little off, honestly.
It's, you know, honestly, it's a little bit to get used to.
Yeah.
You know, like, being familiar with the design of mm-hmm. the characters in the animated film, it's a bit to get used to at first. Even the voices, the character design, I mean, it's not exactly what you know, but it's extremely familiar, and you just have to get used to it a little bit for a few minutes.
And in the end, of course, not in the end, but you finally do, you finally are introduced to the Beast. You see the glimpse of what he turns into at the very beginning, but this time you actually see him fully fleshed out. That scene where, you know, Belle is like, come into the light, and, you know, you see what he looks like. He's not very... It's like they took the design from the cartoon and they're like, all right, we need to do this, but we need to make it a little bit more animalistic. We need to add more of the, mm-hmm. the you know, animal-looking face. We need to add more... They removed any humanistic features that he had in the cartoon, which there was very little. But
well, they kind of just made, in a way, they leaned him out a little bit and made him taller and made his horns taller.
Yeah. Well, they made his horns.
I think the biggest change was in the face, but I think that a lot of that was one of the things that I appreciated the most about the film. The reason they changed the face was to make it a little bit more expressive. In a human way, because obviously Dan Stevens, who plays the prince slash the beast, did some motion capture for the role.
Yeah.
And then they animated on top of it. I think that one of the things that they accomplished better in the live version than in the cartoon was showing maybe the psychological journey, or at least the changing points, better in this beast than in the cartoon. In the cartoon, I mean, it's a cartoon. So he was angry and now he's happy. But here, now that he's a character with a backstory and someplace he's going to go, there are many times that you actually watch him make decisions or wrestle with how to understand a situation or a feeling. I thought it was interesting. He's not the character design doesn't exactly match the cartoon, as with the enchanted objects in his castle. I thought it was definitely to the benefit of the film overall. I think as a character, he tells a better story in this version than in the cartoon.
The Beast.
The Beast, yeah, specifically.
Mm. And speaking about the Beast, you know, the ability for a film to translate something as, like we said, as timeless and something as iconic as the animated version, to translate that into a live-action film, that takes some work. And that takes some, you know... modifying and transforming to make it work for an on-screen, you know, live Absolutely. Action adaptation. The storytelling process of it, I thought actually worked really well in terms of the way this film took the steps to say, okay, we know where the source material for this film comes from. We know the animated classic. We know people love that. We know doing anything other than honoring that is going to cause a riot at Disney headquarters. So we are going to create a story that follows the structure, but it will have our unique story to tell. And I appreciated that about it. It went about the same goals. It had the same goals as the animated version did, but it just went about it a little bit differently.
Yeah, all the main beats are there. All the main scenes and sequences that you remember are in this one, in largely faithful adaptation form.
Very faithful.
It's just the extra stuff that's in there that is different. I mean, even to the point of, I was really intrigued watching the film that they gave, and again, this might be in the original story in the literature, but they gave Belle herself a distinct connection to roses. So like there's this internal unity of the story. Like,
yeah,
not just that she's the progressive, well-read, independent woman that you're familiar with from the cartoon, but that even to the level of the details of her life have kind of always been leading her to this moment, even though nobody would have known it. Because, you know, you've got the enchanted rose that is kept in the west wing of his castle under a glass jar, because the more petals it loses, the more things start to become permanent in terms of these enchantments and this curse. And so he has this wilting rose, enchanted rose, but then she has a whole backstory. Her father, Maurice and Belle, they have this whole reason why roses are important to them.
Yeah.
And it's woven in several scenes in the movie. So I found that just from that internal coherent unity of a script, I thought that was really well done.
Very true. And like we said, the structure it maintains. It hits all the very familiar beats, but adding things like that that add to the vein of it, it adds to the core of the overall story, you know, such as the story of the thread of Maurice being hesitant to explain the details of Belle's mother and having that run through as well, having that connection as well later on in the film, as you soon find out, with Flowers as well. Mm-hmm. Having that connection there, I thought was very unique. It was an interesting touch. I liked how the backbone of each of these characters wasn't just based in how cartoony it can be or how much the animators could get away with before ultimately it becoming just a comedic animated film.
Sure.
It now had it had depth. It had story. It had a foundation set. And those are some of the subtleties that you really begin to realize, even like with the scene where they're doing Gaston's song. You know, no one hits.
Which they changed several of the lyrics for.
They did, but they made it longer, actually. And they added a few different stanzas there that were, I guess, you know, made it work for the film overall. But I have to say, that is probably one of my favorite scenes in the film because of how close it's still to the heart of that scene from the cartoon. It really fits into that, you know, that mold in terms of hitting those same beats but still adding backbone, because throughout that entire scene you see LeFou going over and paying people to engage with Gaston to do the things that he wants to do. They're not just willingly, you know, being ridiculous and jumping on tables and fighting with him. Like, LeFou is going around and he's giving them a few coins so that they could, you know, indulge Gaston with his, you know,
right, and bring him back into a state of happiness.
Yeah. And I thought that was great. I thought it was funny. I was like, that's depth that you don't know. Obviously, not everybody in the village is just this brainless, you know, oh, I'll follow anybody, especially Gaston, because he's got muscles. No, that's not the case here. These are actual thinking individuals who have a mind of their own. And yeah, they're swayed by money because, you know, give them a few coins, I'll jump on the table and dance with Gaston, whatever you want me to do. But it adds depth not only to the character of who Gaston is there, but also the character and the foundation of the people
in
the town.
It's so interesting that you say it, too, because that was a detail that I saw it happening, but it didn't really register as particularly important to me that he was paying people to engage with Gaston. Because the thing that I was surprised to find about myself, because I, like many people our age, saw the movie in the theater, the cartoon movie. Mm-hmm. I saw it a few times on VHS, young people, back in the day. VHS. I've never seen it, I don't think, in the last decade or more. Probably, I haven't seen it in 15 plus years, I'm sure.
We got to change that.
But I was surprised with things, how well things come back to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had, honest to goodness, I had real problems with the musical changes. I think more than like the character design bothered me a month ago when they were putting, you know, character posters out on the internet. And I'm like, that doesn't look like Lumiere. That's stupid looking. That's not Cogsworth. That's a way complicated clock thing. But it's fine. Like, once you get used to it in the context of the story, it's fine. The thing that I had a really hard time with was when they would change the lyrics, when they would change the pacing and the tempo of certain areas of the song, like Be Our Guest. You know, it's this huge, you know, multicolored dramatic showpiece of a song.
Yeah.
But there are moments when, like, once you get in the groove, you remember what the song sounds like, and that is not the song that they're singing exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit different. And I think that was the thing, by and large, you know, the overall motif, because there are, I loved so many things. The set design of this film is extraordinary.
Yeah.
The costuming in many ways is phenomenal. But the music, I've never been a fan of that whole like Baroque harpsichord kind of thing. And it's in every song, and the tempo changes and some of the lyrics changes. It's not that it was bad. It totally fit this telling of the story, but for me, being familiar, apparently a lot more than I realized, with the original, with the animated film, it took me out.
Yeah.
Every time it happened, it took me out of the experience because all I'm registering in my brain is the difference.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yeah. It's as simple as, you know, if you imagine a similar story, The Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
When The Phantom of the Opera came out in movie theaters, people had issues with the way that the performers performed some of the songs, right? More so than the acting or the cinematography, mm-hmm. you know, all the electric guitar riffs were in there and all that kind of stuff. But the way that the vocal performers did the vocals,
yeah,
made some, you know, devoted fans of the stage musical a little on edge because they were so used to this thing and loved it. And this, they did it, you know, a little bit differently. Although it was faithful to the sound and overall pacing and tone of each of the songs, right?
Yeah.
Here, for me, it was difficult because they literally changed every song in at least a small way. And they did it with every single song. And they added some snatches of songs in also. So mm-hmm. I think overall it was more the auditory experience. It put me back in a movie theater in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
Watching something on a screen versus being sucked into the scene. And it's only because of familiarity with the cartoon.
No, and that makes perfect sense because I was actually going to agree in terms of the songs that pertained to everything at the castle I had trouble engaging into because yeah. I'm just going to be honest, I'm not a fan of the harpsichord. I don't like the way it sounds. I think it always sounds like an out-of-tuned piano. I always think it sounds very tingy. It's not a very pleasant noise to my ears. So yeah. Having them incorporate that with a lot of the songs. Now, mind you, I didn't have as big of an issue with the changing of the lyrics, mainly because I think maybe the harpsichord did kind of rub me the wrong way throughout those songs. Like during Be Our Guest, that is very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
During the Tale as Old as Time song, that's very prevalent. And it almost, like you said, it kind of knocks you back into your chair and out of the moment, and you're like, But I don't know. It's that Gaston song. I know there was several changes throughout that entire thing, but I just have to say, to see that song and the way it was performed and have live-action people do it, because there's no animated clocks or animated, you know, candelabras or plumettes or anything that are running around and being a part of the song. It's just a bunch of guys talking about this one guy, you know, who is apparently the greatest thing since sliced bread and, you know, the plague.
Well, so, it was the most like a stage musical. There are several moments where it almost feels like you are watching a stage musical in the beginning, for example, mm-hmm. Before everybody gets enchanted, yeah. Right? It feels like you're watching, like you're in a theater watching a stage performance of a musical.
Yeah.
Then of course the enchanted stuff happens and you can't have that feeling again. But then the Gaston song, that sequence,
mm-hmm.
again, like you said, it's all human beings. It's a very boxy set design.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel like you're watching a stage again for a moment. And then you go back into the enchanted areas and it feels different again.
And going, cause I know we've been on this a little long, we kind of got to move forward, but in terms of that mindset, I think you're hitting it right on the head, because even that scene, the very first musical scene, in the town, the Peculiar Girl, song, that whole sequence to me felt very stage worthy. Mm-hmm. Like the steps that were taken. I loved the brief few, like 2 or 3 seconds of the scene where the school children are stomping up the steps. And as they're singing, you know, you hear the steps and you hear the words, and it's just like, it's very much like in that same vein of something on Broadway.
Yeah. You would think you're on Broadway. Yeah.
And so I agree. There are certain scenes where they do take full advantage, and I wish that whole mindset would have been widespread throughout the whole film. A little bit more of that, you know, wanting to be more grandiose than just let's incorporate this and make that.
Yeah, I think I appreciate the artistic choices that this whole team of people made. I mean, they took some risks. They did not do what we were both expecting, which mm-hmm. was kind of a shot for shot, totally faithful. People love this cartoon movie so much.
Yeah.
Don't change anything because your life depends on it, right? But they did take several risks, and some of them paid off really well. Some of them for me hit a little bit flat, but some of them paid off really well. The backstory for both the prince as a young boy and what happened, you know, mm-hmm. with his parents and his dynamic with them. And then, you know, why does Belle not have a mother in the story? You know, you explore both of those a little bit. And it's something new, and it enhances the overall feeling of the story, I thought.
Did you have a favorite character out of all of them?
You know, my favorite character in the cartoon was Chip the teacup. And I have to say he was still my favorite in this.
In this one?
Some things never change. He's not even in it all that much. I think the thing that I love the most is they were extremely consistent and faithful with at least the demeanor of the character. Maybe not the specific things that he does or doesn't do, but I mean, most of them are what he did in the cartoon.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm more of a purist than I expected to be, because I really enjoyed it.
That scene where you first are introduced to Chip is so cute, and it's so funny, where Maurice is, you know, brought in and he's sliding forward. He's like, "Mom told me not to move," but
it's different than.
I was like, "That is so good."
Because in the cartoon,
so
it was he had a mustache and it tickled him when Maurice drank tea out of Chip. Chip couldn't hold it in anymore because he was being tickled by a mustache. Here, though, Chip like is moving on his own, talking to Maurice. It's the first thing that moves. Yeah, I loved it. Totally my favorite. How about you?
My favorite. So I know I'm going to get a lot of backlash for this, and I'm probably going to get a text message from my brother-in-law in terms of, "Oh, see, you like villains, whatever." But I have to say, I like Gaston. I like Luke Evans' version of Gaston. I love the backstory. I love giving more depth to the character than just, "Oh, by the way, he's this jerk that's in town, and he kills stuff occasionally in the middle of town. Who fires a musket in the middle of town?" But, you know, kind of deal. No, this is a war hero who is home after fighting a battle, after fighting the war, and is just known for being this hunk of a man, you know. But there's depth to him. There's like, "Oh, remember the war, remember these things," you know. LeFou constantly reminds him, you know, of all these things. And it's like, man, I've never been interested in the character or the backstory of this particular individual, but I'd like to know more, you know. So
they toy with the character a bit. I wasn't as fond of him, but they get him in more of a gray area. Again, he's not as much of a caricature as in the cartoon. He does do some things that are in a way kinder or more considerate than mm-hmm. what he did in the cartoon, but then he also does a really, really bad thing before he goes after the beast with Maurice. Like, there's this whole added sequence where when Maurice is back in town claiming that there's a castle somewhere out in the woods with a beast and nobody knows what he's talking about, Gaston and LeFou actually decide to, like, believe him and go with him to try to rediscover this castle and go save Belle, because Gaston wants to marry Belle and this is the way he's going to do it. But then along that journey, something happens and he changes his mind and he does something really dastardly.
Yes.
So... you know, there's a little bit of, I don't want to say it's as extreme as, like, you know, bipolar, but, like, there's a little bit, you know, when he's not getting his way, he's in some ways even worse than he was in the cartoon.
Very true.
But when he is getting his way, he's better than he was in the cartoon. So it's just a little extra nuance.
True, true. In terms of the film, did you, so moving on to one of the bigger questions that's going on with this film, what did you think about this film being actually translated into a live action film? There's a lot of people who are saying, you know what, like you said, the purists who don't really want to see, you know, Disney has a pretty large lineup with this film. They announced the people who will be playing the new Lion King, live action adaptation, as well as with Mulan. You know, we're looking at...
they basically telegraphed Aladdin in Be Our Guest.
Yes.
I mean, there's a huge, like...
Easter egg.
That's Aladdin.
Yeah.
Moment, you know.
What are your thoughts in terms of Disney making this big move with a lot of their classic films?
You know, what I like about it is, you know, obviously there's the whole going back to the same well and not being creative enough to come up with new stories. There is that angle. However, many of the stories that they've decided to adapt over the decades in animated form are quite old and have been told and retold in various ways for generations. Yeah. So in a way, Disney has always, often, not always, often been continuing a tradition that pre-existed Walt Disney Studios, right?
Yeah.
So I think in a way, the thing that I respect about what they've been doing with, you know, with your Beauty and the Beast, with Pete's Dragon, with some of the other things that they've got on the docket is, thus far we've seen them trying to expand, either the mood or the visual or the development of the characters, or the understanding of what this world is in kind of its full-fledged entirety. Again, here in Beauty and the Beast, you get much more of that Frenchness, you know, that French vibe, and the decor and the costumes. It's all much more prevalent here than it was in the cartoon. And I appreciate that. I think that it's a good way of not just taking something that was successful and redoing it to make a lot of money, but you actually do make the effort to enhance it in some way. And I have no doubt that eventually, sometime, it'll fall flat on its face. Aladdin, I don't know how they can pull it off without Robin Williams as the genie. Yeah. I just don't. I very much remember Aladdin. More than Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin was my jam as a kid. So I'm like, I don't even know if I would want to see... I will when they make it, but I don't know that I'd really like. I'd already go in with a bit of a
skepticism.
Yeah, you know, like just Robin Williams was so good through an animated character. Like, I don't know how any live action person, they'd have to change the character to even, you know, make it work. I would think that's an assumption I have. I don't have nearly that strong of a feeling of any of the characters here.
Yeah.
So I think by and large, the changes were acceptable and it was fine because I didn't have a deep attachment. And the main ones, they got right, you know, like really, really right.
Yeah. You see, one of the issues I've had with this film is I don't know if it actually, it doesn't really scream, aside from the architecture and the decor, nothing really else screamed to me. This is a French countryside town and this castle is in, you know, because I think it's because of the lack of maybe the ability of using accents or even anybody who who used, because with the progression that Disney has done, you know, you take Jungle Book, there were people who actually spoke those native languages in the film. There are people who actually had those accents and
well, yeah, but I mean, then you had Ben Kingsley as Bagheera and Bill Murray as Baloo. I mean, like, you still had, you know.
True.
But I agree. I think that that's something that would have made it stick even more.
Oh, yeah. It would have enhanced the experience. You know what? And I'm pretty sure you probably know the actor's name a lot more. I've been racking my brain. And mind you, I guess the thought of actually using IMDb kind of slipped it. What is the name of that French actor from Ocean's 12 who is the other cat burglar?
Vincent Cassel.
He would have played a good Lumiere. I was thinking about it all day. I'm like, that man.
Yeah, but they would have tried to make him Gaston because he's done roles like that before.
True, but I mean, in terms of like French actors who I feel are just so versatile, I think of this man and I'm like, this man has done just about everything. I've seen him play fathers to, you know, to the innocent people, to the actual villains, I've seen him play everything. And I'm like, this man, no offense to Ewan McGregor, he's a great actor, he's awesome, but I mean, that French accent was atrocious. I mean, I could not.
But I think it was supposed to be, like...
Was it?
In the cartoon version, it was cartoony. And
it was very
Pepe
Le Pew-ish.
Yeah, and I think that here, they were, in a way, trying to honor that. I mean, they weren't trying to make him sound authentically French. He just happened to be the only one who was really trying to sound French.
Yeah, so I think... adding more of that into the actual overall structure, giving more credence to the idea that this is a French countryside town, this is a castle in France, all those things, you know what? That would have been the step up from just a shot-for-shot recreation of the animated version into live action. That would have been like, all right, we're going to take this product, we're going to take this property, and we're going to bring it up a notch, and we're going to show people that we're entering a new realm of Disney. This is a whole new chapter of Disney. And what are we going to do? Hey, let's find some, you know, let's find an unknown French actress to play Belle, or let's find an unknown French actor to play whomever, to give a little bit more credence to that.
You know, it's interesting because now I'm thinking back to, you know, I had mentioned Phantom of the Opera before, mm-hmm. which is also French. The story's French, the setting of the play and the musical, everything, it's French. They have usually in the productions, they have like one or two characters who actually speak with French accents. Most of the others typically don't, you know, so maybe it's just the performing style. I mean, you got the whole thing where they're like, well, British accents are most trusted and refined and, you know, elegant and whatever. And so that's what everybody should perform as a British person, of course, you know. Yeah. But so you've got that, you know, that whole shtick in the industry as a whole. But I agree. It would have definitely done more to ground it even further in terms of the audible cues in addition to the visual cues.
Yeah, because I would not have known this was a French film. Like, as a child, you don't know that this is supposed to be like a French fairy tale. You don't know any of those things. And it's not really vital to the cartoon aspect. True. If you're watching it as a kid, that's all to itself. But as an adult, that's something where I'm like, yeah, I think that's relevant. I think, you know, that's something that maybe, the French might appreciate, you know, or even whomever, wherever this story came from. I think that would have added a little bit of more of the homage to the origin of this tale as opposed to just the cartoon. But overall, I think the film, it definitely was a good film. It was definitely one that, you know, is a you know, unique take on that property. And yeah, you know what? I'd actually be willing to see it again to kind of catch a little bit more of the things that I didn't catch the first time. Because it does have a lot of little subtle Easter eggs, like the Aladdin Easter egg and a lot of other things that people don't really, you know, probably wouldn't catch the first time. So I probably would see it again. What about you?
Yeah, I think that I won't be like, I won't be going to the theater to see it again, pay money to go see it again in the theater. But I think that knowing now, especially for me, the way the music is different, it would have been great to have had that as front-loaded knowledge. I think it wouldn't have necessarily changed my overall perception of the film, but I think seeing it a second time, knowing that the music is not going to be what I consider exactly what I'm familiar with, I think it would be a more pleasant experience overall because I wouldn't have those moments where I'm taken out of the movie.
Yeah.
Entirely my own fault in a way, like it's what I was expecting versus what I was given, you know, but that's the way it was. I'd see it again.
So, Chad, on DVD. Does the film pass, and how many monocles do you give it?
I think that it definitely does pass. I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
Really?
I think it's a solid. There are several things that I really appreciated. Again, the set design, phenomenal. I really appreciated the specific micro expressions for the Beast as he's going through his emotional arc. I thought the mocap and whatever they did for that was really, really well done. There were just some things that didn't really do it for me, mostly the musical options. How about you?
It does pass for me. It is something that I would definitely recommend for anybody who has a child or anybody who is, you know, reminiscent of the animated version. You know, if you'd like to see something that's pretty much that in live action form, I'd say it's a pass. And I'd probably give it a 3.5 out of 5. You know, I like the music. I like the character development. I liked a lot of what I saw. But there were just certain subtleties throughout the film that kind of pulled me out of the overall experience. I was like, yeah, I don't know if that works. But let's go again. Let's try one more time. And we get back into it.
Sure.
And like, yeah. No, okay. Okay. One more time. Let's go back in. So too much of that. I got to give it that. It's a solid good effort. Like you said, I'll give it.
Absolutely.
But in terms of, you know, me, where it stands in my ranking, I give it a 3.5.
Yeah. Well, I can see that. One of the things we didn't talk about were some of the vocal challenges. Because, I mean, you can tell that some of them, they needed a little digital help with a few of the notes.
And Beauty and the Beast, La La Land edition.
Whatever. But you know, you can tell, like, when you're used to listening for that kind of stuff, it's all over some of the audio tracks.
Yeah.
You know, so if I was really being critical, I would come down from my four, but you know, I put it lower just on account
of... You just love Chip that much, don't you?
But I do. He's always been my favorite in that movie. Well, I identified with him as a child.
Hey, you know,
I don't know why, but I did.
I can see it work. But again, if you have any thoughts on this film, please let us know in the comments on our Facebook page or on our Twitter page. And you know what? We'd love to hear what you got to say. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a little bit of movie news. At the top of our list, Tom Cruise has been training for a Mission Impossible 6 stunt for a year.
I love this.
So,
and I can't stand watching the Entertainment Tonight and extra TV specials of Tom Cruise and the stunt stuff. I'm like, I'm over it. It's cool. He always tries to one-up himself. But this, something about the way this story has come to light in the past few days... He has already been training for a year for whatever crazy stunt they're going to do in this movie.
For one stunt.
I love that.
So according to a recent interview with Skydance Media CEO David Ellison at South by Southwest for the premiere of the upcoming sci-fi thriller Life, Ellison offered an update on Mission Impossible 6, which he's producing. "We're thrilled," he said. "What Tom is doing in this movie, I believe, will top anything that's come before. It is absolutely unbelievable. He's been training for a year. It is going to be, I believe, the most impressive and unbelievable thing that Tom Cruise has done in a movie. It's going to be mind-blowing." So here's the thing. I like great stunts. I like all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Tom Cruise just needs, you know... I don't know what he's getting fed over at that Scientology center, but he needs to just, let's tone it down a bit there, buddy. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, a story like this, I start wondering, like, will something happen during production of this stunt?
Yeah.
Because he's pushed it too far.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't know what the stunt is. We know that it's not going to be climbing a really, really, really tall, you know, the world's tallest building because they already did
done
that.
Done it.
Hanging on the outside of a plane while it takes off.
Done that.
Holding your breath for 6 minutes underwater.
Check. Done that.
Right. So it's like, okay, what else? Running through a giant crowded street scene while things are blowing up all around you.
I figured it out.
Oh, you know what it's going to be?
Oh, yeah. He's going to get swallowed by a whale.
Ooh.
And then he's going to get spewed out on the third day.
Oh, like Jonah. Okay. I was thinking something like, you know, jumping from a platform in space. You know, like, like that
Red
Bull YouTube video, right?
Something while boxing a kangaroo and doing a Rubik's Cube at the same time.
Mm.
So
anyway, I think that level of dedication, as much as I'm not really much of a Tom Cruise fan anymore, his early day stuff I liked more than any of the recent things, but you've kind of got to respect the work ethic.
True. I think. I mean, I'll give it to him. I mean, the man is up there in his years. I don't know exactly how old he is, but I do know he's not a spring chicken. And so this is getting to the point to where he's continually meeting the wow factor of these films. And, you know, if there's something that he's going to do that's going to top everything he's already previously done, hey, I mean... I'd be willing to pay to see that.
Absolutely. So, I just hope it works.
I just hope he doesn't die from it.
In production, because he literally, they do the stunts. It's not CGI. These kinds of stunts, there's a lot of practical effects work and stunt work that goes into these. It's not visual effects.
Tom Cruise, you can have it. Filming on the sequel begins on April 10th. Last piece of news we got is the Terminator Genesis reboot series is reportedly dead. So the New York Daily News is reporting that Paramount has terminated Arnold Schwarzenegger, Emilia Clarke, and presumably Jai Courtney's contracts to return to the franchise. A source told the tabloid publication in the following, "It is over for the Terminator and Arnold. The studio has taken the sequel off the production slate completely, meaning there is no pre-production or any plans for another sequel."
Which is interesting because the same guy that we were quoting in the article a second ago, David Ellison with Skydance, he also has released a statement through Collider that they're going to be making a new announcement about the Terminator franchise this year. And there have been rumors that James Cameron might be back involved A fairly official capacity, not as director, but like maybe story consultant or something.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see like how these two streams converge. If there's no Arnold Terminator, but there is a Terminator franchise, what does that mean?
Overall, yeah, because if they're going to go away from the Terminator, actual Terminator perspective, is it another Terminator Salvation kind of deal? I mean, you know, that's the only thing that comes to my mind. But
which, as anybody who's followed the show from our first episode knows, we actually both really appreciated certain aspects of Terminator Salvation.
That we did. But that about wraps up another great episode. You know, we're excited to you know, let us know how you thought about the film. And, you know, let us know in the comments on the Facebook page at facebook.com/philosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. And let us know what you thought about the film. If you liked it, you didn't like it, you like Chad's voice, you want him to call you at night to give you, you know, little lullabies with his voice, we can make that happen. Just let us know in the comments on the Facebook page or the Twitter page.
Making me blush.
One thing before we let you go is we do have a awesome giveaway
this
to talk
so
to you about.
So good. I mean, so, if you've hung in till the end of this broadcast, you are in luck.
So we are giving away an awesome Beauty and the Beast Funko Pop package of all these incredible Funko Pops, and you
these
can check
things
out,
are the like some of the best, most detailed mm-hmm. Funko Pops I've ever seen.
So here's the way you got to do it. If you've been listening thus far, then in order for you to win this, you have to retweet or repost the link for this video, for the show. And with it, I need you to hashtag what Chad's favorite character is from the Beauty and the Beast franchise. So he said it a couple times. So if you were listening, you caught on. So post the link for our show, and with the hashtag in there, hashtag Chad's favorite character. And we'll be looking through and we'll be checking out, seeing who posted what, and we will pick a random winner, and they will get this awesome prize
package.
We're
going to post a photo of what these products look like on social so you can see them. But I mean, really, these are like quality.
Oh, yeah. I have to hide them before Chad takes them and wants to, you know, take them to his house. So, yeah.
Steal them.
So that about wraps up another awesome show. We're glad that you were a part of it. And, of course, like we said, if you have any comments, drop them in the Facebook or Twitter page. This was an awesome review. I love talking about this movie. It was a great opportunity to kind of get your idea and get my idea and kind of put them together and put it in the show. So
that's right.
It was awesome. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.
Au revoir.